An hour later, when they were back at Sunspot, Doc realized the extent of the Skagworm's unhousebrokenness. The men tipped a garbage can against the rim of one of the cauldrons, then carefully opened the lid. The muties were no longer black. They were streaked end to end with vile-smelling, ochre-colored excrement. The men slid the Skagworms into the boiling water. An ochre froth billowed upon the water's roiling surface, spilled over the rim, and oozed down the sides of the barrel. Doc moved upwind to escape the ghastly aroma.
Oh, by the three Kennedys!
We scald them a while to make sure they're good and dead and to clean up all the runny shit.
After a 15-minute boil, the Vilfolk sieved the dead worms out of the barrel with pitchforks. When the worms were cool enough to handle, the men shoved sharpened iron rods under their belly plates from tail to throat. They fitted four worms to a rod, then started roasting them over the coal bed. Clear juices dripped down into the fire, spitting clouds of steam. Post-boiling, the aroma was much improved.
They smell like shellfish when they're broiling. Like lobster or crab.
As the cooks rotated their skewers, the black shells gradually turned gray, then glowed red. When the shells finally split along the backs, the worms were removed from the heat. After they had again cooled and were unskewered, the women used claw hammers to shatter the armored heads, exposing the end of a tube of meat that was easily pulled free of the carapace. An inner liner, like a sausage skin, protected the lump of muscle. After they had stripped the meat from the liner, the women used carving knives to hack it into bite-sized chunks. They dropped the flesh into the second 55-gallon drum of boiling water, along with the collected vegetables and herbs. The vat of stew cooked at a slow simmer until after sundown, when portions were finally ladled out. As Doc had hoped, all of Haldane's Sekmen lined up for chow. It was a no-fuss, no-muss way to accomplish the mission Milosh had given him. His head turned slowly as he took them in.
Are you counting the Sekmen?
It's a habit. An old road warrior likes to know what he's up against. It appears the opposition numbers 60. Is that all of them?
All but the 8 stationed on the wagon footgates. And there's another 8 still out on patrol. Sometimes they spend the night outside the berm, depending on how far they've gone on their sweeps.
A sizable force by any measure. Shall we take our suppers over to the fire?
They carried their pint cans of stew to a fireside log and sat hip to hip, a foot apart.
What do you think?
It's chewy, but in a pleasant way. It doesn't taste of the sea as I thought it might. It's rather more like possum, only less greasy.
This is the answer to our prayers. The Almighty has chosen to save the people of Sunspot from a horrible death, to lift our impossible burden. It has to be for some reason, for some great purpose. Can't you see the hand of God in this, Theo?
I do.
But it was a heartless God whose hand Doc saw, and he was that God's lying instrument. With his assistance, Sunspot was about to change occupiers again, with the accompanying loss of life. It was possible that the woman beside him would be killed in the process. That wasn't a concern he had anticipated a few hours ago. Though he wanted to warn her, he couldn't, for fear the word might reach Haldane's men, which would put his companions, who were part of Malasha's assault, at greater risk. If Isabel survived the coming battle, she would certainly take his action for the cowardly betrayal that it was. He had his friends' lives to consider, and yet Isabel was sending unmistakable signals with those violet eyes of hers. He could see that she found him attractive. His strange Victorian manners, speech and bearing, and his innate sadness had cast a romantic spell. Even as he resolved not to press this advantage, he found himself leaning over and kissing her. Her mouth was soft and warm and pliant beneath his. And a surprising sensation passed between them. It was electric. When Doc broke off the kiss, he saw the rosy color rising in her cheeks. The experience, though brief, seemed to have sucked the very breath from his lungs. He knew he had to stop before things went any further. He could not, in good conscience, court this lovely, brave woman. That would be heaping betrayal upon betrayal.
Excuse me.
What's wrong?
I cannot. I'm sorry.
Theo! Theo! Where are you going?
Doc didn't look back.
Not our ville.
The companion's standard disavowal of responsibility had never rung so hollow. As a salmon-pink sunset faded to black on the horizon, Magus' convoy circled and stopped on a flat stretch of desert hardpan. Just enough daylight remained to make camp and batten everything down for the night. Thus far, the chem weapon caravan hadn't attempted to travel after dark. Even with every headlight blazing, it would have been far too dangerous. The potential road hazards and risk of rollovers would have forced an even greater reduction in speed. Now that they were within spitting distance of Malasha's army, creeping along in a parade of halogen lights was a very bad idea. When the road trash piled out of the Humvee, Baron Haldane followed suit. Only then did he realize they had reached their destination. To the north, some 8 miles away, along the summit at the mouth of the gorge, were the pinpoint firelights of Sunspotville. After tomorrow, lights would never again dance on that black ridge of rock. Haldane stifled a shiver. There was a decided chill in the air now that the sun had gone. The first stars of evening were coming out.
In an hour, it's gonna be colder than a bull doomy's tits.
Only there won't be no fires for the likes of us tonight. Don't want to draw attention to the camp in case the Impaler has long-range patrols out.
In the purpling light, Baron Haldane headed for the side of one of the 6x6s, where his Sekhmen waited. He looked from face to shadowy face and saw grim expressions. And with good reason. They were outnumbered and outgunned by Magus's Coldhearts. As they looked on, the gun crew unhitched and unwrapped the Lyagushka at the edge of the Ring of Wags. Very soon, their Nuevaville kin would be under the sights of the Soviet artillery piece, inside the kill zone of the pre-dark WMDs, and the hand on the trigger cord had steel fingers. Haldane took his men aside, out of earshot of Magus's crew. He hunkered down while they huddled around him.
I want my son back, alive and in one piece.
We need to know where Magus has got him stashed, before we make a plan.
Bollinger was Haldane's head Sekhman. He was tall, squint-eyed, lantern-jawed, and harder than pre-dark steel. Unscratchable. A man after the Baron's own heart.
He's in the landship with steel eyes.
That wag is gonna be a tough nut to crack. We can't see inside. They've got all the bulletproof shades pulled down. What's the floor plan?
There's a long, skinny corridor running through the full length of the thing. And just one armed guard that I saw. You could have more now. There are steel doors spaced along one side of the hall. The salon at the back end is where Magus does his experiments. Thorn could be in any of the cabins, or with Magus.
Seems like Magus would keep him close by, for safekeeping.
We've got problems unless we can force Magus to show his hand. Sweeping that wag room by room is gonna get my son killed.
Are we gonna try and rescue him before the gas attack? Tonight, maybe? I wouldn't mind chilling a few dozen of these road scum in the bargain.
If we do that, Magus might not fire his chem weapons at Sunspot. He might turn them on Nuevaville, out of pure spite. Nothing can be decided until we evacuate our garrison from the Ville. Once they've joined us, we have a chance against Magus. We'll outnumber his men almost 2-1.
When you send men to Sunspot to collect the others, you reduce your force down here by that number. If there's a hang-up, if something goes wrong, you won't have enough guns left to free your son.
That's why I'm only sending 3 runners to the Ville tonight. Bollinger, pick a pair of men to go with you. Steer clear of Malash and bring our soldiers back.
The head Sekhman chose his team, and they battened down and rattle-proofed each other's gear. Magus knew the Baron was going to pull back his troops before the barrage, so there was no need to conceal the operation. The runners had 8 miles to cross at night, with only stars to light their path. Haldane knew the trip could take 3 hours or more, each way. As Bollinger and the others shouldered their weapons and walked off into the gathering gloom, one of the Baron's remaining men looked over his shoulder.
Uh-oh. We got company.
The huddle of troopers gave way, letting the dreadlocked Sekhman from the landship approach Haldane.
Magus wants you to eat dinner with him in his wag. He told me to tell you that it was to celebrate the eve of your great victory over Baron Malash.
It was an offer the Baron couldn't refuse.
Grub's on now, and Magus don't like to be kept waiting.
Haldane followed the man down the circle of wags. When they reached the wag, dreadlocks again relieved Haldane of his Remington 12-gauge. The Baron was bathed in bright electric light.
Go on, third doorway along the corridor.
Haldane was glad that supper hadn't been laid out in the butcher's grisly playpen. The Baron opened the door and looked into a tiny, windowless, olive drab-painted cell. A single, bare 100-watt bulb hung from the riveted metal ceiling. The table was also made of painted metal. There were two steel benches built into the walls on either side. On the right-hand bench sat Magus.
Where's my son?
Safely tucked away.
I want to see him, now, to make sure he's safe.
Your boy is perfectly fine. You can see him after dawn tomorrow, when our transaction is completed. Sit down. Our meal is growing cold.
Various uncovered serving dishes were set out on the table. Roasted, sliced meats, some in their own juices, some in thick gravy. Stewed vegetables, piles of long, thin noodles, a gallon jug of foaming ale. If not for the company and the circumstances, Haldane would have found the platters appetizing. The Baron didn't press the issue of seeing Thorn. He hadn't expected Magus to give him access to his son. The most he could hope for was a clue where he was being held in the wag. Haldane took his place on the opposite bench, across the narrow table from Steel Eyes. He was practically knee-to-knee with the creature. The smell of transmission fluid and fleshly decay competed with the delicious aroma of the food. The Baron chose not to show his disgust, for fear it would be seen as a sign of weakness.
Please, begin. Help yourself.
It's very good.
Magus nodded as he chewed. After a moment, he picked a plastic squirt bottle from the table, opened his still full mouth, and sprayed what looked like water between his lips. It occurred to Haldane that perhaps Steel Eyes either lacked or had inadequate saliva glands, which meant he had to lubricate every mouthful with water to fully pulverize it. Though the Baron watched and waited for Magus to swallow the bolus, he never did. Instead, he spat a golf ball-sized wad of finely masticated food onto his steel fingers and slapped it onto the side of his plate.
Eating for the purpose of sustenance is a dim memory for me, I'm afraid, but there is still the pleasure of the taste. Why don't you try some of the spaghetti sauce? It's my own recipe.
Where's my son?
Safely tucked away.
I want to see him now.
Thorn Haldane may have been alive, but he was not perfectly fine. The boy was still crammed in the tiny pre-dark pet carrier. The only position he could assume was fetal. The carrier sat on an unmade bunk in a pitch-dark cabin. Before the lights went out, he had gotten a good look at his surroundings. The room was packed with junk. Moldy papers and electronic parts and disintegrating cardboard boxes. Because the air vent was open, he could hear every word of the conversation between his father and Magus in the cabin next door. Thorn would have shouted or kicked the cage to let his father know he was close, but Magus had booby-trapped the cage, placing a shaped explosive charge on the carrier door. The creature had shown him the remote detonator, a whitecoat gizmo the size of a deck of playing cards. Magus had threatened that if he made so much as a sound, a split second after killing him, he would kill the Baron. By letting himself get caught by Magus, he had put his father at a terrible disadvantage, and he had put him in terrible danger. He knew his dad would never give up until he was free.
Why do we have to leave here? I like this ville. I got my own can of food, and people don't spit on me all the time.
Remember your friend Bezoar?
Oh, yeah.
If we don't depart Sunspotville tonight, by this time tomorrow, your friend is going to be 15 feet in the air on a maypole.
Like in Redbone?
The self same. We have got to go.
Can we come back?
Yes, of course. And we'll be returning very soon.
You like the one with the pretty eyes, don't you? You kissed her. I saw you.
Well, yes, I kissed her. But we must put that aside and leave this ville. Bezoar's life depends on it. Come.
Doc pulled the Drooly into the shadows beyond the reach of the firelight. There they waited for the dinner party to break up. Eventually, the Sunspot folk began to slip away in ones and twos to their pallets in the cargo containers and rusted-out Winnebagos. Haldane's Sekmen retreated to their barracks in the Welcome Center. As the last of them crawled off to bed, the unattended campfires burned low and the flames winked out. leaving beds of glowing red coals.
We're going to climb the berm.
Badrulli looked up at the shadowy 15-foot-high pile of loose rubble and dirt, but asked no questions. Doc had decided that they couldn't leave Sunspot via the footgate. If they tried, they would have had to explain to the sentries why they were heading out into the hellscape in the middle of the night. They couldn't risk waiting until daybreak to make their exit. There was a chance they wouldn't be allowed to leave. Moreover, they needed all the time available in case they got lost en route, or if Malash had moved the column from its last position. Given the dark, moonless night and their distance from the Welcome Center and ramshackle shelters, as long as they moved quietly, they would attract no attention.
Make no noise!
They slowly started up the 45-degree incline. Because the berm was made of loose-piled debris, and there was only starlight to see by, it was difficult to locate solid hand and footholds. Crad's weight caused a minor collapse in the structure. They froze near the top of the berm, but no one burst out of the semi-trailers to challenge them. Given the building materials, such mini-avalanches were common occurrences, no doubt. After descending the other side of the perimeter wall, Doc and Crad turned left and skirted the edge of the heap. Outside the front gates, bonfires were burning, presumably to deter predators. The light they cast only penetrated 30 or 40 yards into the darkness. Doc made a wide detour around the pyres before rejoining the path to the interstate on the slope below. They walked down to the pre-dark highway. The old man could feel his back muscles bunching up into knots. Night was the worst time to be out and about in the hellscape. Unless you were trying to commit mutie-assisted suicide. As dim-witted as he was, even the Drooly was aware of the extreme danger.
So dark.
Below them was the eerie, vaguely outlined, colorless landscape of ruined forelane and towering, canted light stanchions.
We're fine. We'll just follow the interstate and retrace our route back to Malash.
As they moved along the highway shoulder, Doc felt the hairs on the back of his neck stand erect. He had a powerful sense of being watched. He drew his Lama.
Wait a second.
Stinks here.
The stench of a freshly excavated grave was unmistakable. That the swineherd could smell it over his own pungent aroma was a true measure of its intensity. 30 feet ahead was a pile of heaped earth and overturned stone slabs. Approaching cautiously, Doc reached down and grabbed a handful of soil. It was still damp. On the other side of the mound was the source of the terrible odor. Severed body parts. Strewed long bones. A headless torso. The rotting corpse had been partially devoured. Belly first.
Good Lord.
Doc doubted that he was looking at the handiwork of a skagworm. A worm wouldn't have bothered pulling the body out of the ground to feed. It would have just burrowed in and done its dining out of sight on the buried pocket of protein. The creature that had disturbed the grave had to overturn the heavy capstones and pull its meal out of the earth, which meant it was bigger, stronger than the worms, and to grapple with the stones, at least two-armed, if not two-legged. As he scanned the darkness at the edge of the shoulder, Doc considered the possibilities. A 500-pound scaly? Scalies were lazy, slow-moving bastards, and they liked weak or injured prey, or prey they could ambush at close range or trap in some way. The grave robbing could also have been the work of a band of roaming cannies. It was too dark to make out any now. For cannies to dig up graves, they had to be triple desperate, congealed human blood and decaying tissue being preferable to no blood and tissue at all. Their alternative to starvation was to eat one another, which they usually only did when a member of the band became too sick to live. Something crossed the four lanes left to right in front of them, about 40 yards away. Though the light was dim, we could see that it was neither scaly nor canny. It was the size and height of a full-grown bull or an ox, and it had more than four legs. For its size, it was amazingly quick and light on its feet. In a crouching run, it disappeared into the pitch-dark desert. Doc swept the highway shoulder with the sights of the Lama. There was nothing to shoot at.
Damnation. I think it is running back along the road to the east, trying to cut us off from the Ville.
They looked behind them, at the distant fires perched on the silhouette of ridge.
We go back now?
That isn't an option. It's already probably lying in wait for us.
We go on, then?
If we do that, it will run us down from behind.
There was only one choice, Doc realized. Because he could shoot, he had a chance in hell of holding off the creature long enough for Crad to get away.
Can you find your way back to Bezoar?
Uh-huh. Broken bridge.
That's right. Turn at the broken bridge. If I tell you a number, can you remember it? This is very important. To save Bezoar and my friends, can you remember a number?
I can count to four.
There was no time for drooly games. Doc set down the Lama and unsheathed his sword stick.
Give me your palm.
When Crad extended his hand, Doc seized it by the wrist.
Hold still. This will only hurt for a moment.
Holding the sword near its razor-sharp point, he dragged the edge across the drooly skin, making quick, shallow slashes.
Ow!
Find Malash and show him that mark on your palm. Can you do that?
Crad looked down dumbfounded at the scratches in his flesh, which oozed a thin trickle of blood.
Can you do that? Then go! Now! Run!
Crad took off without further prompting, clutching his injured hand to his chest, lumbering barefoot into the darkness below. Duck started back up the grade. There was no way of knowing whether the Drooly would find the column in time. He could only hope. Grimly, Duck advanced with a heavy pistol raised. Every broad puddle of shadow, every low hummock along the road's edge, could have concealed his enemy. He was determined to confront the monster head-on, and to at least cripple it. He had his Lama to accomplish the task. After that, he only had his sword stick to rely upon. As he neared the highway exit for the Welcome Center, between the turnoff and the 100-yard-wide blown-up section of road, the creature reappeared from the shadows. It squatted in what was left of the slow traffic lane, all eight of its legs bending at the first joint. The body was a vague, flattened oblong. As the beast turned back into the darkness, the silhouette didn't change, which told Doc the body was roughly circular in shape. Doc knew he had to lure it closer, to within sure killing range of the black powder pistol. He advanced to the spot where it had just stood. His eyes were skinned for the slightest movement, his ears pricked up to catch the faintest sound. Before him was a wide pool of semi-liquid excreta. The creature had marked its turf. Duck rounded the wet spot. The thing suddenly raised up from a depression in the roadway ahead. The .44 caliber ball went right into the center of its body. The resulting plume of gun smoke momentarily obscured the creature. Undaunted, Doc walked through the twinkling haze, straight for his target. Because of the combination of the weak light and unfamiliar animal, he wasn't sure precisely what to aim at, but he gamely continued. The beast seemed impervious to lead balls and content to wait for its dinner to come to it. As Doc advanced through the smoke, he got an impression of shaggy hairiness and savage cunning.
Expire, beast!
Doc cocked the hammer on the blue whistler barrel. Duck stole a glance in the direction of the Villgate.
There! I see someone! Come on!
He saw a line of torches bouncing down the path toward him. Haldane's fighters were coming. Instead of leaping upon him right away, the creature scuttled to the right and took cover behind a rubble pile. The .44 caliber balls might have stung it a little after all. Doc knew he couldn't stop to reload the revolver. He had to press his advantage, if indeed he had one, relying on the Lama's single-shot, scattergun barrel. Perhaps a load of grape shot at close range could create a wound grievous enough to kill or hobble it. Doc stepped unblinking into the jaws of death with a raised pistol in his hand. The many-legged thing surprised him by springing away in a tremendous bound. Duck instinctively led it with the Lama's sights. Unable to see anything through the burning black powder, his ears momentarily ringing, he holstered the empty weapon and drew his blade, preparing to pursue his quarry into the darkness.
Stop there! Don't move or we'll fire!
Duck turned to face torches and assault rifle muzzles.
Put that stabber away! What the hell are you doing out here?
The old man knew that taking the night air wouldn't suffice, nor would seeing a man about a dog. There was no good explanation for leaving the berm's protection before dawn.
You didn't go through any of the gates. You must have jumped over the wall. Why did you sneak out of Sunspot? Wait a minute. You showed up this afternoon with a drooly. Where's your drooly pal?
The creature took him. I tried to help him, but bullets didn't stop it.
Bastard's gotta be a spy for Malash.
We hang spies around here.
Bollinger didn't make a headlong rush for Sunspot. We had 6 hours to get there and return before the gas barrage started. There was time for caution, though forcing himself to take it slow made his stomach jittery. Safety was far more important to his mission than speed. He knew if he didn't make it to the Ville and warn the garrison to pull out, all of Haldane's soldiers would die, either by the hand of Melosh or the hand of Magus. These were troopers Bollinger had personally helped train and had commanded in battle. The Sekhvahs sensed his two subordinates were jumping too. Many lives depended on their success. With starlight dimly reflecting off the sand, Bollinger led them along the clearest route, keeping to open ground as much as possible, keeping away from pitch-dark patches of brush, boulders, and deep, narrow gullies. That way, if they were ambushed by men or muties, they had a chance to return fire. Bollinger could see their goal ahead, rising above the shadowy hills. Firelights twinkled against a black backdrop. He didn't let his gaze linger. The danger was much closer and all around. The Sekhvahs knew everything there was to know about Sunspot. He had helped Farron Haldane take the Ville from Melosh twice and had been stationed there himself for months. During that time, he had learned to hate the rank shitpile and its people. He had lost many dear friends during the campaign's advances and retreats. He had come to view the Ville folk as sneaking, lying, cheating bastards and murderers. While he had been in command of the Sunspot garrison, they had assassinated 4 of his soldiers in one night. Bollinger had caught the guilty parties and hanged them in front of the whole Ville. He had strung up the Ville leader for good measure. He still wished he could have hanged them all, men, women, and children. Though the prospect of their impending annihilation with gas pleased him, he was less enthusiastic about Melosh's receiving the same fate. Given the man's history of atrocities, it seemed far too easy a way out. If offered a choice, the Sekhvahs would have preferred to drag the still-living Baron by his heels behind a wag for 20 or 30 miles, until there was nothing left but leg bones and feet. Bollinger was sweating hard as they hopped down into a wide arroyo. His mouth was bone dry, not from the exertion of the trek or the lingering heat. The tension was starting to get to him. A man could only stay hard-focused for so long without losing his edge.
Let's stop a minute.
It was okay to move across open ground. It was definitely not okay to take a rest break there. His assault rifle braced against his hip, finger resting on the trigger, Bollinger headed toward a low, grass-fringed bank on their right. The crumbling, undercut bluff was draped in deep shadow. He approached it carefully, making sure that nothing hid in the darkness.
Sit in the shadows, backs against the bluff.
They broke out canteens and sipped water. They kept their weapons ready and their senses alert.
How far to go?
Maybe 5 more miles.
I'm thinking the Ville folk are gonna know something's up when we pull out all our troops at once. We've never done that before.
Yeah, but they won't know what the something is until it's too late.
All those dead people are really gonna stink up the place.
That'll bring on the buzzards big time. You think the poison will chill them too?
Yeah, stone dead. Them and anything else that wanders by. That sarin gas is triple nasty. Breathe it, you die. Taste it, you die.
Suddenly, the dirt before them exploded with tremendous force. The man sitting next to Bollinger was decapitated. His head toppled forward into his lap and bounced out of the shadows, landing face up in the starlight. The still thrashing body beside them was suddenly jerked backward, out of sight, into a hole that hadn't been there moments before. Bollinger jumped to his feet. Just then, the other soldier was seized around the waist from behind before he could rise. He was seized and shaken so violently and so rapidly that his body actually blurred before Bollinger's astonished eyes. Caught in that monstrous, crushing grip, the trooper couldn't break free, nor could he breathe or scream. All the poor bastard could do was kick his legs and flail his arms as his ribs collapsed. The monster tried to burrow into the dirt, stopped by the man's body still in its grip. The second time the soldier hit the hole, he doubled over like a rag doll at the waist and vanished. Bollinger vaulted away from the bank. He hadn't clearly seen what had just taken his men. He was left with a vague impression of smooth, domed heads, like the noses of 500-pound bombs, and heavy, powerful jaws. Jaws that could cleanly sever a human neck in a single bite. Whatever the hell they were very large, very quick, and very deadly. When he glanced down the arroyo behind him, his heart sank. In starlight, the dry river channel was alive with movement. Glistening, sinuous movement as the earth vomited forth dozens upon dozens of black, segmented creatures. They poured out of the ground and slithered toward him, moving like streaking shadows above the sand. Even if he could have hit them, there were too many for him to shoot.
Oh, shit. Oh, shit.
Hollinger turned and broke into an all-out sprint. He felt good, felt strong, light and fast on his feet. Thanks to a jet-assisted adrenaline rush, he could make it. He was sure he could make it. He had to make it. He pushed past his own limits, trying to put as much distance between the muties and himself as he could. If he could make them give up hope of catching him, he had a chance. That was the only way he was going to reach the Ville alive. He didn't think about how far he'd run, or how far he had to go, until his legs started burning and growing heavier and heavier. His pace faltered. He began to stumble. He knew then that he wasn't going to make it. In that last moment of despair, he begged his doomed friends in Sunspot for forgiveness and cursed the god that had abandoned them all. Something heavy latched onto his right ankle and wouldn't let go. As he dragged it along with him, the creature writhed and shook its head. The savage movement caused its serrated jaws to sever tendons and ligaments and score deeply into the bone. Hot blood squished inside Bollinger's right boot. His foot went dead. In the distance, he could see the firelights of Sunspot. Help was far away. Too far away. Pain lanced into his other leg, and he tripped, crashing face down in the sand. The creature swept over him in a chitinous wave. Rolling over onto his back, he instinctively raised his hands to cover his face, which opened his torso to attack. Once the 2-foot-long black worms sank their jaws in his belly, there was no getting them out. While he pulled and pounded on the powerful armored bodies and the rippling rows of scratchy bug feet, the worms shook, snapped, and burrowed in a frenzy. He could hear his ribs breaking like dry sticks, and then they were squirming inside his torso, fighting over the choicer bits. Only when one of them made a meal of Bollinger's beating heart did his agony end. Crad hightailed it downhill, his injured hand raised and clenched in a tight fist, blood trickling steadily down his arm. He ran parallel to the ravaged highway. The loose flesh of his face bounced and jiggled with each impact of bare feet in the sand, as did the heavy muscles of his chest and stomach. Snot and twin clear streams trailed down his cheeks and swayed from his chin. The swineherd was a strong man in the prime of his life. If he knew how to do one thing, and one thing only, it was how to flee. Crad was a dimmy, but he was smart enough to be scared. The memory of the creature he'd just seen put wings on his heels. What stuck in his mind most was all those legs and the sheer size of it. Not only did it have twice as many legs as normal, 8 instead of 4, each leg had too many knees. 4 or 5, it seemed, all capable of bending. When it straightened its legs and stood to its full height, Crad could have walked under its belly without crouching. Other than Bezoar, Crad had never had a human friend. And he'd certainly never had a friend who would sacrifice his life for him. And that's what Doc Tanner had just done. The act of selfless heroism amazed him. That it had been done on his behalf made him feel wonderful and horrible at the same time. And he didn't understand why. His new friend Doc had hurt him, cut on him. But he was accustomed to being hurt. Crad was crushed that he had lost a friend like Doc so soon after finding him. Pathetic and limited and grotesque as it was, his world was collapsing around him. He knew he was in mortal danger, though, and that he would be safe when he reached the camp.
Broken bridge. Broken bridge. Broken bridge.
It was a 2-word prayer to ward off the thing with too many knees. The shattered blocks of the collapsed 4-lane span came into view below him. He scrambled over the up-tilted plates of roadbed and dropped down into the dry riverbed. Without pausing to look behind him, he ran north, up the white channel. After traveling a 1/4 mile, he climbed out of the riverbed and into the low hills. He didn't have to think about where he was headed. He didn't look to the stars to find his direction. Below the conscious level, some ingrained homing sense told him which way to go. He ran up and down the slopes of the low hills for what seemed like a very long time before he crested a rounded summit and looked down on a wide hollow where Malasha's fighters had made camp for the night. Though there were no fires and no lights, he could make out horses, mules, dogs, carts, tents, and scattered everywhere, the dark forms of men sleeping curled up on the ground under the stars. Krad was so relieved and so excited to see them that he didn't think to yell or to wave his arms to announce his return. It didn't even occur to him that there would be sentries on duty and that they would be armed. He raced full speed down the hill toward the camp. From behind rock outcrops on either side of him came starburst muzzle flashes, and he was caught in a withering crossfire of lead. Krad didn't know what to do, so he shut his eyes and kept on running. Ryan Carter couldn't sleep. He sat cross-legged on the ground beside Mildred and JB. Though they were curled up side by side, they weren't asleep either. In the starlight, he could see that their eyes were open. He figured they were thinking about the same thing he was, and feeling the same extreme sense of urgency. The whole camp was dark. The Baron had ordered no fires. Even though they were settled in a hollow, the combined glow would have lit up the surrounding hilltops and given away the position to Haldane's force in Sunspot. Darkness presented a perfect opportunity for the companions to slip away. All that kept Ryan from organizing an escape was Doc Tanner, who hadn't returned from his involuntary spy mission yet. As soon as he showed up, they could sneak past the perimeter guards, moving in ones and twos so as not to attract attention, and join up somewhere to the west well after dawn. By the light of flickering muzzle flashes, Ryan saw a lone, shadowy figure running with arms raised through a withering hellstorm of slugs. The figure only managed a few steps before crumpling and falling. Then, driven by gravity and its own momentum, it rolled head over heels down the slope.
Hold your fire!
Although they were unsure who had given the order in the dark, the guards obeyed. Ryan was already dashing over to the still form. When he got close, he was relieved to see that the man lying on the ground was the red-bone swineherd. He rolled the man over onto his back, expecting him to be shot full of holes and stone dead. He was surprised to see the barrel chest heaving and the button eyes blinking. Mildred and JB were already beside Ryan before he could even call for them. Mildred quickly checked Krad's body for bullet wounds, and finding no evidence of serious injury, made him sit up.
It doesn't look like he's hit except for his hand.
Luck of the dimmy.
Come on. Come on now. Let me see your hand.
Mildred carefully opened his bald fist and held it that way while she poured a little water from her canteen on the wound to soften the congealed blood and dirt. Then she started to gently clean it with a scrap of rag. Behind them, the whole camp was on its feet, weapons out, adrenaline pumping. Malaj the Impaler burst from his tent.
I want my officers here! Now!
Where's Doc? Where's the man who went to Sunspot with you?
When Krad didn't answer, Ryan took hold of his baby-smooth chin and squeezed until the first two joints of his fingertips disappeared into the fleshy cheeks.
Where's Doc?
A thing chased us.
What kind of thing?
Big! It was hunting on the old road. He told me to run, and he went back to chill it.
Did you see him chill it?
No.
Did you see it chill him?
No. He shot and shot and shot, and then it got quiet. I was running hard as I could.
You didn't go back?
He said to come here.
Ryan, we don't know that he's dead.
That's true. But if he was okay, he would have caught up with the drooly. He'd be here by now.
Maybe he's hurt. Maybe he's down.
Fire blast.
This isn't a bullet wound.
At that moment, Malash stepped up behind them, accompanied by his cadre of staff officers. The Baron held a burning torch that cast a ring of weak, flickering light on the ground around the companions. He leaned down in all his black-masked, black-caped glory.
What did you find out?
Krad looked up at the Baron. There was blind panic in his eyes.
You better have found out what I asked you to.
Mildred raised the swineherd's palm up to the torchlight for them to see.
Look! It's the number 76! Doc must have done this. He knew Krad wouldn't remember it. He cut it into his hand so he couldn't lose it. So we'd have to see it.
Smart geezer.
You bet your ass.
If there's only 76 soldiers in Haldane's garrison, we can overwhelm them with main force.
Where's that scout? Get him over here.
When the scout approached, Malash held the burning end of the torch close to the sand.
Draw the defenses for me again.
The scout knelt and started making a sketch in the dirt with the point of his knife. Ryan had to squint his good eye to see it. First, the man drew the circular oblong of Sunspot's burn. On the south side, he put in the gorge with the interstate running through it. He crosshatched a section of highway directly below the ville, indicating a major break in the road. On the north side of the berm, and parallel to it, he sketched some narrowly spaced contour lines, which were meant to describe the steep back of the hill on which Sunspot sat. He added a path on the gorge side, running from the interstate up to the Ville and out the other side, bypassing the disrupted section of highway. The scout finished by adding the heavy machine gun positions.
They've moved the emplacement since we were there last.
Together, the gun positions provided overlapping fields of fire, nearly 360 degrees of kill zone. On the south, or gorge side of the berm, two widely spaced emplacements controlled the western uphill approach from the interstate and the westernmost path leading to the Ville. The path leading from the Ville to the east was controlled by two more emplacements. A fifth machine gun was positioned on the north side of the berm, defending the steep hillside approach. Malash stuck a gloved finger in the sand, pointing out the weakest point on the north side, the widest stretch of undefended berm wall. It was the very spot Ryan would have picked.
The main force attacks here at first light. On my signal, the Norm fighters will breach the berm and take out the two gun posts on the west, here and here. The muties and dogs will follow them through the breach and contain any resistance inside the Ville. Before I call for the main attack, I'll lead the troops up the gorge in a feint to draw the garrison's fire. Once the berm is breached and the defended gun posts are knocked out, I'll take the western path and break through on that side. Any questions? Assemble my army.
Soon, 300-odd fighters stood packed in a solid mass before Malash in the hollow. Malash walked his horse a short way up the slope, far enough so he could look down on them all. The two of them formed a stunning black silhouette in front of the starry field of sky.
They say life is cheap in my barony. They say it's thrown away on a madman's whim. They say that I'm a monster without conscience. I say that's all lies. Life is the most precious thing. That's why we fight and chill and die, to preserve it. We have the right and the obligation to those we hold dear to take what the rich barons in the East are too weak or too careless or too stupid to protect. The wealth of their baronies is waiting for us. But first we must conquer Sunspot. We must take it and hold it. With Sunspot in our control, we can bleed the bastard rich barons dry and convoy the food and loot back to our home bills and our families. Some of you have not come here of your own free will. Even now you are thinking about escaping before the fighting starts. I say there is no escape from death for any of us. And the only brief victory that death allows is glory. Glory while we still live and breathe. I offer you the chance for that glory. The chance to carve your own bloody mark on this land. To take what is yours from it. Follow me, and I will lead you into that place where the bullets whine and men scream. My glory is there too, in the teeth of that howling gale. If a baron isn't afraid of what's to come, why should you be? You have nothing to lose. I have everything to lose, but I won't hide from the Reaper's blade. Show no mercy to any of Haldane's fighters. With bullet or blade or club, dispatch them straight to hell. But let the Sunspot folk who drop their weapons and surrender live. They can fight alongside us in the battle for Nuevaville. The Norms and the Muties will follow my officers. As for those I have consigned to be cannon fodder, I would never ask another to do something I would not do myself. I will proudly lead the cannon fodder into battle!
Leading a suicide squad was the last thing anyone would expect of a Deathlands baron. As a rule, barons delegated the really dangerous work to the highly expendable, easily replaceable, and utterly despicable muties under their command. If barons rode into battle at all, they did so only after the conflict was well under control, to exercise their backhands by hacking off a few enemy heads, maybe emptying a few banana clips of 7.62mm rounds into rows of bound captives. Around him, Ryan saw awe in the faces of the new Redbone conscripts, the wounded and the young, and the old and the lame. The seasoned cannon fodder, those who had marched behind Malash before and survived, swelled with pride.
For Baron Malash!
With a single unexpected gesture, the Emperor had turned the tide of sentiment from dread and fear to something that approached real enthusiasm for the coming battle. He held them, not just the fodder, but the entire 300 in his gloved fist.
Malash is no sham of a carny master. He's something infinitely more dangerous. Kodak Bastard's a red-blasted hero.
Nuke in hell. Most of the fodder don't even have sticks to swing. What the fuck is he up to?
He's trying to convince Sunspot that the main attack is coming from the west, up the interstate.
No better way to do that than to ride at the head of the force himself. He's a little hard to miss in that outfit.
He said I had balls.
Don't tell me this rah-rah stunt changes your opinion of the Impaler.
A big set of balls doesn't make him a sweetheart.
Any more than it makes you one?
Exactly.
Malasha's army didn't break camp as much as they walked off and abandoned it. They left behind everything that wasn't vital to the battle. The tents, carts, mules, and food supplies. The troop of cannon fodder limped after the masked baron and his chestnut steed, heading over the hill in the direction of the interstate. As the sacrificial ranks filed past, Ryan saw that the two Redbone swine herds, Bezoar and Crad, had been reunited. The long row of troops in the main column was easy to get lost in. There were at least 250 souls, not counting dogs. Ryan moved slowly enough so the other Norms had to pass him. In this way, without drawing attention to himself, he gradually dropped back to the end of the Norm ranks, along with Mildred and JB. Figuring Ryan would do just that, Christy and Jack advanced to the front of the muties until they were walking right behind their companions.
Doc never turned up.
The Drooly did.
Doc could be dead already. Or he could have been captured by Haldane's men. There's no way of finding out before we attack the Vill. Malash isn't going to let us wander off and search for him.
From the way the Drooly tells it, Doc sacrificed himself to get the word back so Malash wouldn't skewer us. So we'd have a chance to get away.
That's why we're not going to leave him behind.
Ryan looked over his shoulder. Meconium had moved to within 10 feet of them. He held a massive dog by a chain around its neck. Swampies were sour-faced by nature, but he was extra unhappy.
That Swampy looks like his dog just died.
It did. I blew its head off earlier. I didn't want to, but he didn't give me any choice. That's Meconium, the boss Swampy. I would have shot him too, but I was outnumbered.
I bust his nose good.
Doesn't bother him. He's a mouth breather. And he's got himself a new dog.
It was some dog. The beast was nearly as tall as Meconium. It had pointed ears and huge feet. Ryan slipped between Christy and Jack.
We're gonna get split up once we reach the Vill. The Norm unit is going over the berm first.
What are we gonna do?
We don't have any choice. We have to follow Malash's orders. It's the only way to get into Sunspot and locate Doc. If he's there, we've gotta find and free him as quickly as we can while the battle is still underway. If he isn't there, he's gotta be on the interstate, maybe wounded, maybe dead. Whether we find him or not, we need to regroup once we're inside the Vill. We meet close to the western gate. We can use the confusion to slip out and head down the interstate.
If he's in the belly of some muti, we're never going to find him.
Hey! Snowface! Get your muti ass back here where it belongs!
Ryan glanced back at Korb.
He belongs square on my hairy face!
Jack faked a move toward Meconium, and the Swampy not only flinched, but jumped backward behind the dog. The animal started towing Meconium forward in the hope of taking a chunk out of Jack.
You better hold that pooch nice and tight this time. I think you remember what happens if you don't.
No more of that. You shoot another dog and I'm gonna blow you clean in half. Move to the rear of the line, you two. Do it, now!
Christy gave Ryan a wink. Then she and Jack dropped back among the shuffling shadows and disappeared from sight. It took the better part of 3 hours of steady walking to circle to the north of the gorge entrance. Looking up at that side of the ridge, Ryan could only see 2 bonfires burning. From Sunspot's vantage point, the column was invisible. Without a moon, there wasn't enough light to pick out the formation's approach. At the base of the ridge, the officers began dividing the Norm fighters into 3 assault waves. Ryan leaned close to one of the officers.
Me and my 2 friends would like to be in the first bunch that hits the berm, as a matter of personal pride. Is that a problem?
Not at all. We're gonna tear Haldane's bastards a new one this time.
Ryan waved for JB and Mildred to follow him to the head of the line. If they were the first ones over the breach, he figured they had the best chance of locating Doc before someone else shot or clubbed him to death. At the officer's signal, Ryan, Mildred, and JB, and the rest of the first wave began to climb single file up a kind of deer or goat trail that was no more than a foot wide. It zigzagged up a slope that varied between 45 and 60 degrees. Half the time, they had to use both hands and feet to advance. There was no vegetation. It was bare rock. And they couldn't see more than a few yards above them. The north side of the gorge was both the toughest route to attack and easiest route to defend. When Haldane's soldiers got wind of what they were doing, they were dead meat. They had no cover but the side of the hill. If the enemy started firing down on them from along the edge of the ridge, they didn't have a chance, and it was a long way to fall. Which was why Milosh was making such a show of coming up the gorge. The feint was designed to draw attention from the real spearhead of the attack until it was too late to do anything. When they neared the ridgetop, at the officer's command, they fanned out in a line that paralleled the berm. Lying flat on their stomachs, they slowly crawled closer to the lip of the cliff. They were almost directly across from the gun emplacement. Ryan raised his head, just to the level of his good right eye, confident that his black hair in the night would hide him. The weapon they faced was a Predark heavy machine gun, .308 caliber, belt-fed. The M60 was swivel-mounted on the roof of a Chevrolet Suburban in front of a large hole that had been hacked in the sheet metal. Steel plate replaced the windshield and side windows. Its rear end wasn't just backed up against the berm, it was buried by it. From the looks of the vehicle, no tires on the front rims, dozens of rust-ringed bullet holes in the fenders and grille, it hadn't run in more than 50 years. Ryan counted two soldiers behind the gun, although there could have been more inside the SUV. There was 70 feet of open ground to cross before they reached the berm. When Ryan ducked back down, he gave JB and Mildred the info using hand signs. Two enemy. Then he signaled the letter M and 6-0. The sky to the east was already starting to turn from ebony to lavender. False dawn was almost upon them. Ryan checked the SIG by feel, easing back the slide, reaching in with a fingertip, making sure he had a live round chambered. JB carefully snicked back the bolt of his Uzi, putting a 9mm round under the firing pin. Mildred wiped the sweat from her palm on the tail of her t-shirt, then regripped her check wheel gun. On the other side of Mildred, Milosh's officers knelt with a satchel charge and pre-dark frag grenades at the ready. Below them in the dark, the rest of the Norm Force and the muties and dogs crouched on the slope, waiting in considerable discomfort for the signal to charge the summit and break through the berm. The gunfire erupted from the gorge side of the ville. The fight for Sunspot had begun.
The Norms and the muties will follow my officers. As for those I have consigned to be cannon fodder, I would never ask another to do something I would not do myself. I will proudly lead the cannon fodder into battle!
For Baron Milosh!
For nuke's sake, don't give Crad that fucking thing!
Ferdinando, the one-armed leader of the cannon fodder, paused before handing Crad a well-worn AK-47, steel-shod butt first.
I said, don't give him that blaster. Unless you're looking to get shot in the ass yourself, he doesn't know one end of a blaster from the other.
The young swineherd had never been offered a functional firearm before.
Yeah!
He eagerly grabbed hold of the rear stock and the curved magazine and tried to pull the AK to his bosom with main force. Ferdinando was triple quick. He snap-kicked Crad in the groin. When the stoop's knees buckled in slow-mo, Ferdinando jerked the weapon out of his hands and passed it over to the 10-year-old boy standing next to him. Though the Baron's cannon fodder was meant to absorb lead, not dish it out, they had to throw up some gunfire, or the Haldane force would realize their assault was a ruse. As Bezoar looked around, he saw weapons being passed out to some of the old, the young, and the ambulatory infirm. Even though it was dark, he could see the rest of the AKs were battered old weapons, too. Then again, there was no reason to give decent weapons to the walking dead. The uplifting sense of power and pride the Baron had instilled in Bezoar was fading with every limping step. The elder swineherd knew they were going to die, and soon. Unlike the men, women, and children marching behind him, who were still bright-eyed and eager for the fight, he had a hard time seeing anything positive in drawing his final breath.
You shouldn't have come back for me, Crad. You should have run off when you had the chance.
Now, instead of just me, we're both gonna be dead.
I was too scared to run. I had nowhere to go. Are we really gonna die?
Where do you think we're going now? To a picnic breakfast? Hell yes, we're gonna die. We're all gonna get shot to pieces.
When the cannon fodder column finally reached the interstate and the dropped bridge, Milaj turned them toward Sunspot, detouring around the dropped overpass. On the far side of the rubble, because of the highway's upward incline, the going got more difficult for Bezoar. It forced him to lean even harder on the crutch. It was too dark to see the mouth of the gorge in the distance, but the silhouette of the ridgetop against the stars and the firelights in the left-hand rim gave Bezoar a sense of its size.
Where's the glory in being led single file into a slaughterhouse?
Bezoar caught a powerful reek of ammonia. It got stronger as they advanced farther. Some kind of vile liquid spore had been sprayed over the ground.
It's the thing! It's what dug up all the graves!
Take it easy. It won't dare attack. There are too many of them.
How do you know that?
It was hanging around the last time I fought you, when the dead horse fell on me and I lost my arm. Seemed like there was only the one. Like a big cat. I guess it needs a lot of territory to hunt. We never saw it during the day. We just found the tracks in the sand along the side of the road. And the beast, or sheep, or whatever it is it leaves behind, probably lives in a hole somewhere out in the bush. Only comes out at night. Can't bury the dead deep enough or pile enough rocks on the graves to keep it from digging them up. Free eats for a big-time scavenger.
Legs! Lots of legs!
Yeah, and it moves so fast your eye can hardly follow it. We never found any part of the dead ones that he took, either. Snatches up his live victims the same way. Zip! And they're just gone. Probably carries them back to his hidey hole. You made your peace yet, Pigman?
Working on it.
Well, don't work too long. Once we step into the gorge, nuking hell's gonna break loose. You and your triple stoop buddy better be ready to meet your maker.
False dawn was breaking in front of them as they neared the entrance to the gorge. In the faint light, Bezoar could just make out the looming walls of rock that bracketed the interstate. Blazing fire cans on the ridge lit up the sides of the three gun positions that commanded and controlled the stretch of ancient highway. The line of sacrificial lambs was about to enter a well-established kill zone. Bezoar knew the heavy blasters outside Sunspot's berm had to have the range locked in. It was too dark to see clustered bullet holes and rows of spall marks scraped into the roadbed. And of course, there were no bodies or body parts to stumble over, as the creature had taken care of cleanup. Malasha's strategy was to move in just before the break of dawn, so the Vill defenders couldn't see that they were up against a token force of cotton tops, peg legs, and 8-year-olds. Dread hung over Bezoar in a sickening fog as they advanced into the jaws of the gorge. There was no cover that he could see ahead. It was a 4-lane highway with no divider except for a dirt strip. He couldn't make out the gun barrels on the high slope above, but he imagined their gun sights cracking. He lowered his head and trudged onward, though it was even harder for him to walk, what with one knee stiff and the other gone all to rubber. If the gunners on the ridge saw them, then they held their fire, letting the column advance until it was completely within the kill zone.
Get ready to run.
Where to?
There's cover on the far side of the turnoff.
At that moment, Milaj turned to his troops.
Run!